Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An unregulated skincare industry means the consumer has to decide for him or herself what's best for their skin. Sifting through the options from gels and creams and lotions and serums makes for a trial and error process with little return on investment. Talking to other consumers about what works and what doesn't is part of the solution. Senior Associate Editor for The Atlantic, Julie Beck, recently wrote about the issue. We'll post a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Julie Beck.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
For the article, you described the skincare aisle at your local CVS pharmacy. What were you looking for?
Oh, it was ridiculous. I went in there with a little notebook and a pencil, and I was like hunched over in the aisle for like an hour just making little tally marks. And I didn't even get to all the categories I was going to do because it took so long. So I was counting like how many products made acne fighting claims, how many products made anti-aging claims, and then also just like how many different kinds of face lotion and body lotion there were. It's not a big aisle either, so it's pretty staggering.
What's the big attraction? What's the big ticket? Is it acne? Is it anti-aging? What reigns in the skincare aisle?
You know, I think that so much gets like shoved under the umbrella of skincare, and like it really depends for different people. Like if you have acne, if you've ever had acne like that, you know that kind of becomes your main concern. And then as people get older, obviously, you know, we want to put off the ravages of time or what have you. But it's, you know, it's medical things. It's just, like, you know, making skin smoother and softer or glowier. It's, anti-aging. It's just being protected from the sun and like having clean skin and being moisturized. Like any of these things can be skincare. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's like a very wide range of conditions and things that you're trying to do.
How big is the industry in the United States now?
It is big, suffice it to say, and growing all the time. I think there's definitely been a bit of a shift of focus in the sort of beauty space from cosmetics to skincare. Not that like people are not into makeup anymore, but you definitely see a lot more discussion of skincare than I think you used to.
When did that start?
I would hazard to say like maybe in the past couple of years, 2 years or so. That's just me kind of going off the cuff though.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, like anything else, it is a trend. I think a lot of the, you know, importing of the Korean beauty products has been a big part of that because they have a lot of, you know, sort of high-tech, cool skincare stuff that people got really into. I think it's partly this, like, no makeup, makeup look, right? But if you want to have no makeup, makeup, then you have to look good without makeup. Mm-hmm. And, like, where does that lead you?
It's a conundrum.
So it's yeah.
You wrote that the skincare industry straddles the line between health and aesthetics. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. It seems to me, maybe there are others, but it seems to me to be the only industry where it's just very unclear what things are drugs and what things are cosmetics. And I mean that in the like FDA sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like the FDA like defines cosmetics as things that like alter the appearance. But then it defines drugs as things that affect the structure or function of the body. And I think you can see where, like, with some of these skincare products, like anti-aging stuff, like, where does altering the appearance become altering the structure or function of the body? It's not so clear. And because the regulations are so much more strenuous for drugs, a lot of companies, like, make great effort to stay on the cosmetic side of the line where they can, but they're still kind of trying to indicate to you that this product is going to have the result that you want. So it can just be really, really confusing.
What do we know about why the FDA doesn't regulate this branch more or at all?
I don't know like what the decision making behind that was back in the day, but I mean, like, cosmetics are innocent until proven guilty, pretty much. And drugs, you have to prove that they're safe and effective before you can release them. So by staying on the cosmetic side, like, even if a particular ingredient has been studied and has evidence on it, like take like vitamin C, for example, they don't have to prove that in the specific formulation they're selling you with all the other, you know, non-active ingredients, that it's still active, that it's still effective, that nothing about the way that they're formulating it changes how it works, that you just don't know.
What about when it says something like dermatologist recommended or something like that? Does that change the tack?
I don't know if that means anything on it. Like, all they have to do is find one dermatologist, right? Mm-hmm. I think you can find, the easiest way to find out is to just look at the back of the thing. And if it says drug facts, then that ingredient is a drug. And if it doesn't say that, then it doesn't. And pretty much the only ones in over-the-counter skincare that are drugs are acne medications like salicylic acid and benzoyl peroxide. Adapalene is Differin, which was recently approved, and then like sunscreen ingredients.
You also wrote that the skincare industry is purposefully confusing. How so?
I mean, I guess that's somewhat my interpretation. I can't truly know their minds and hearts. But, you know, when I was like hunched over in the skincare aisle, right? And I was literally just trying to tally how many lotions there were. Mm-hmm. Like, the words that they used to describe lotion, like it was lotion, moisturizer, cream, gel, gel, cream, mm-hmm. like salve. Intense hydration concentrate. And the one that like was the most horrifying to me was daily liquid care.
Yeah.
Like just say lotion, man. What is that?
But there's little to no research on skincare, at least on the outside looking in, right?
There is research. So it's really challenging because, you know, for one, academic papers are not usually available to the lay public. So even if you wanted to do that research, you'd have a hard time getting access. A lot of the skincare research that's out there is skewed more towards medical conditions like acne and eczema, you know, perhaps understandably, mm-hmm. And the sort of ingredients that fight those. That's a lot easier to get funding, I think. And then if there are studies on some of these more over-the-counter ingredients, they're usually smaller studies. They're fewer and farther between, and they're, you know, really hard to find, or they may be sponsored by the companies themselves. So there's just a lot of issues in trying to find good data on some of those things.
Well, I mean, we know the companies are doing research because, if for no other reason, there's protests against companies that research on animals. I mean, they're doing some kind of research, but that's not open to the public.
Right. Yeah. So I was sort of thinking more about like scholarly papers and things like that. But you're absolutely right. Like, I'm sure they're definitely testing things internally, but they're not under any obligation to publish that online or anything if you just want to look it up.
You know, in that CVS aisle, how many lotions/ et al. Did you find?
Oh, let me find it for you. Okay. So there were 106 different acne products.
Wow.
There were 101 different anti-aging products. And when I say different, I mean like sometimes it would be the same lotion with like three different SPFs. And I kind of counted those as different, or it was like one was for dry skin, one was for extra dry skin, mm-hmm. one mm-hmm. was for, you know, so they really differentiate them in such granular ways. And then there was 155 kinds of body lotion and 177 kinds of face lotion. So
well, it's interesting how people have sort of glommed onto each other, consumers, and are talking about these things among themselves. You talked about Reddit in particular. Tell us about what you found there.
Yeah. And this is what I think is so interesting, because I think it's probably not surprising to people to hear how confusing the skincare landscape is and how unregulated it is. But what's great is like people are, in the face of that, they're kind of creating these little communities, like the Reddit that you refer to is one called Skincare Addiction, and there's like 450,000 members or something like that, where they just pool their knowledge. And, you know, because we're all trying things on our own skin all the time, they pool their knowledge, they look up papers, they sort of do crowdsourcing, and it's according to some of the dermatologists I talked to and people with, you know, chemistry PhDs, it's not bad. It's pretty good advice.
Well, what about the dermatologist? What's their role out there? Can I run something by my dermatologist and they can tell me whether it's good for me or not?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they're like great fonts of knowledge. And if you want to just kind of go over your skincare routine with them, I'm sure they'd be happy to help you. But to some degree, these things just aren't known. So like, you know, there's not research that says what is the right concentration of like vitamin C to use. Like, you just don't know. And also, you know, for the lay person, like, they're probably not going to go to a dermatologist unless they have a condition that like really warrants that. So like, you know, serious acne or eczema or something like that, mm-hmm. they're probably not just going to pop by and be like, what face wash should I be using? Mm-hmm. You know?
Hmm. What about you? How did this affect your skincare routine?
Oh, I mean, I've had terrible skin forever since I was a teen.
Ergo, you know, your interest in this?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, they always tell you that acne goes away when you become an adult, but that's not always true.
They lie.
Yeah. And so what's interesting, this, I think it sort of demonstrates like the very kind of ramshackle nature of this, because, you know, I do see a dermatologist and I have like prescriptions from her. So that's the medical side of it. But then it's also sort of cobbled together with things that my friends have recommended or things I saw on skincare addiction, and just kind of like really doing trial and error on that over the years.
So what do you use?
You want me to list my skincare routine?
Yeah.
Well, I have a prescription from my dermatologist for acne. I have a couple of prescriptions from her. I have a couple of different serums. One that I think I'm actually not going to use anymore, based on some of the reporting that I did.
Yeah.
And a sunscreen in the morning and the lotion at night. And I use these like Stridex. Sorry to like.
No, that's okay.
Brand names.
Stridex has been around for 100 years.
Yeah. I'm trying not to endorse anything really. Salicylic acid for like exfoliation, and then I have another like sort of peel exfoliator that I use a couple times a week.
You know, I was interested to read in your article that like things like toners, they've never worked for me. I have really dry skin and I've always rejected them, and there's always somebody trying to push them on me saying, oh no, it's just, that's just bringing out all the whatever in your skin. And it's like, yeah, my skin looks worse when I use it. And you had a dermatologist say that that's one thing that people should really pay attention to.
Oh, yeah. One of the dermatologists I spoke to said she doesn't think that, you know, most people need toners at all. I don't totally understand what they are, so I'm hesitant to, like, say.
Yeah, I don't understand.
But I think it's mostly alcohol.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem super necessary. So.
Yeah, that's right. They always say it brings out the impurities in your skin. No, it just makes my skin yucky. Julie Beck, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for chatting.
Julie Beck is a senior associate editor for The Atlantic, covering health and psychology. We'll have a link to her article about the skincare business. So check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 1 billion people worldwide suffer from high blood pressure. That's according to a new study which found that most with high blood pressure live in middle and lower income countries. Joining us now to talk about that and more is cardiologist at Mount Carmel Health and founder of the nonprofit Walk with a Doc, Dr. David Sabger. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. You have a great show. I'd love to talk to you.
Thank you. Most of the people that had high blood pressure in the study that I just mentioned were living in middle and low income areas of the world. What do you make of that?
Yeah, this was a really important study to show that. They found that some of the reasons associated with communities in low and middle income countries are lead exposure, pollution, unfortunately as well, poor nutrition early in life, and maybe increased sodium, potassium in their diet. And finally, as you know, one would expect or suspect, a lack of diagnosis and treatment options that are available in some of the higher income countries.
The study found that the number of people with high blood pressure has almost doubled over the past 40 years. That's phenomenal, really, isn't it?
It is. While the population has certainly grown, as you mentioned, the prevalence of high blood pressure has far exceeded that. What's interesting is in the U.S. and some higher wealth countries, the levels have gone down. But overall, over 225 million people in China, 200 million people in India. So we have a significant global problem.
Well, places like China and India, they've kind of adopted a lot of bad Western ways. Plus, they are becoming industrialized, and those environmental issues, they don't have the same kind of environmental protections that we do in the United States. Do you think that plays much of a role?
Absolutely. Kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah. Men were found to have higher blood pressure than women, all things being equal. What do we know about why that is?
That's a good question. I do believe it's like, you know, men typically will get cardiovascular disease 10 years earlier, and this is, you know, certainly one of the reasons why. Obesity is an issue. It may come down to hormones and transmitters that are seen in guys more than women.
What is hypertension?
Hypertension is synonymous with high blood pressure.
Okay, so that's exactly what high blood pressure is. And why do they call it hypertension? What's the origin of that?
You know what? That's a really good question. I've never heard that asked. There's high blood pressure causes tension in the arteries. So hyper having elevated tension in the arteries. And, you know, that's one of the issues we run into is the, you know, let's say a blood pressure of 140 over 90, which is elevated. That can cause the arterial walls, which have muscle, to thicken. And unfortunately, as you know, lead to heart attack and stroke.
The arterial walls thicken in response to the tension?
Yes.
Why is that?
They're having to deal with that higher blood pressure, and that is their physiologic response to it.
Some call high blood pressure a silent killer because it carries no symptoms, or at least no symptoms that are noticeable. What should people be looking for? They should get their blood pressure checked, right?
Absolutely. That's a critical point. We very likely will not feel anything, but with all the blood pressure cuffs that are available at pharmacies we often go to on a regular basis, grocery stores, and also the cuffs that are sold at the pharmacies are very reliable, and we recommend to our patients that they, if they do have high blood pressure, that they have a cuff at home.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about high blood pressure. There's a new study that I mentioned earlier that most of the people that have high blood pressure in the world live in middle and low income areas of the world. My guest is Dr. David Sabger. He's a cardiologist at Mount Carmel Health and founder of the nonprofit Walk with a Doc. If you have a question for the cardiologist, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why are some people genetically inclined to high blood pressure?
Oh, wow. That's an involved question. There are certain ethnicities that just are tend to have higher blood pressure, and it gets into the genomics, which is something that I'm probably not the best expert to speak on here, but there's definitely a family history associated with this. That said, it is such a pandemic that we just see it everywhere.
I've known people who have had high blood pressure in their 20s and early 30s. Really surprising and very serious. Why is that?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of risk factors. It's directly related to weight. So we often see as the weight goes up, the blood pressure will go up. Sedentary lifestyle can contribute to that. Alcohol use, poor diets high in sodium. All can contribute to that. And unfortunately, with, you know, the sedentary epidemic and the obesity epidemic, we're seeing it now, as you mentioned, in patients in their, you know, even teens, 20s, 30s.
Is that usually weight related, though?
It often can be, but it's, you know, unfortunately, our diets are, you know, I'm making a gross stereotype now, but they could be improved overall. And there's, you know, that's maybe one of the fun things about treating blood pressure. There are a lot of things we can do before we go to the medicines that most everyone does not want to take.
When we talk, you know, oh, that really got my blood pressure up, you know, when something happens, something stressful, how much is stress really associated with high blood pressure?
Great question. It will directly, you know, affect some chemicals in our body that will send our blood pressure up temporarily, and that's the direct effect. But it can also relate to indirectly. If someone is a stress eater, for example, or when they tend to get stressed, they don't exercise as much, it can have those indirect effects as well.
So how do you know, what's the point at which you know that medicine is needed?
We do try and go with lifestyle modification first. The goal right now is 120 over 80. That's the latest numbers. And we'll have a lot of patients that if they're in the 120s, 130s, 140s, we'll try things like if there's room to grow, for example, with increasing physical activity such as walking or increasing fruits and vegetables in the diet, decreasing salt, things like that. Every practitioner is different, of course. I like to go to those things first, monitor the blood pressure, and then go to medications if we need it. I like to think of medications as a temporary thing. A lot of times when the weight comes off, the blood pressure medicines can go away. But finally, we do have some, you know, I have patients that are marathon runners that eat, you know, a really beautiful diet and still have to be on medication.
Uh-huh. And are there procedures besides medication that you turn to when all else fails?
There are, but that is extremely rare. One example would be a blockage or stenosis of one of the arteries to the kidney. That's one. One that's actually not as infrequent would be sleep apnea. We've seen that sleep apnea is highly underdiagnosed in our community and can, you know, successful treatment of that can significantly reduce the blood pressure.
And let's talk about, you referred to a beautiful diet. What's a beautiful diet when it comes to high blood pressure?
Yeah, well, the main one that's recommended, as you've heard, is a Mediterranean DASH diet that's low in sodium. And more doctors now and patients are going to a plant-based diet that can be hard to follow for a lot of people, but it's a very successful, healthy diet. I personally like the crowding out theory, which I've heard from some dietitians that I really respect, of just kind of making subtle changes, increasing fruits and vegetables when you get to the grocery store. spending more time in that produce section and loading up as much as you can. So that's, you know, that's really where the battle is won and lost, is at the grocery store. If it doesn't get into the cart, it doesn't get into the pantry.
Well, we have a message from Anita in Columbus who asks, what about people with chronic low blood pressure? What medical interventions exist? So what's the problem with low blood pressure?
Yeah, low blood pressure, Anita, that's, I would imagine it may be something that you're familiar with. We don't see it that much, and typically when we see it, it's due to someone like me prescribing too many medications that lowers the blood pressure. You know, there's a saying, as long as you can walk, talk, and pee, your blood pressure's okay, but if you can't do those things, then what we typically will do, and this is rare because in most patients we need to lower the salt, but there are times where we need to recommend maybe a little increased salt and hydration for those patients that do have hypotension or low blood pressure. There are also some medications such as midodrine that you have to go to if someone is low, but anecdotally I probably see 100 patients with hypertension for every one I see with hypo or low blood pressure.
And the symptoms you're saying is they just don't have enough energy.
Yeah. Fatigue definitely can be one. Maybe some confusion, lightheadedness when you stand up, dizziness. Those are common.
Okay. Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air with Dr. David Sabger. Hi, Beth.
Hi there. I was wondering if I could put my father on because he had a little trouble with hearing, but now he's fine. And his question is going to be about erratic blood pressure readings.
Okay.
Here he is, John.
Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
For several years I've had quite erratic blood pressure readings, and it has not concerned me a great deal, but they have been getting more and more erratic lately, and also I've been having erratic pulses, which has not happened before. And I took my blood pressure last night 7 times in a row between 12:30 and 1:30, and I've got the results on that. Out of 14 readings, high systolic was 0, low systolic was 2, high diastolic was 1, low diastolic was 4, fast pulse was 10, and slow pulse was 4. And they're not extreme readings, but they're over what I would consider concerning.
Well, let's ask Dr. David Sabger, what about erratic blood pressure readings like John is talking about?
Yeah, great question, John. And it matters. Blood pressure is rarely the same number twice in a row, and typically if it's within 10, 15 millimeters mercury on the top number, which is also called the systolic, that is reasonable. One thing we look for, different blood pressure difference within the left and the right arm. If we notice a separation of 20 millimeters, that's something where we may want to look for other issues. John, with the erratic heart rate that you're having, that's something that may be contributing to a different blood pressure. I don't have enough information over the phone, but there's a condition that's pretty common called atrial fibrillation, which could cause the blood pressure to vary and go up and down. But I would say if you're within 20 millimeters systolic, that's reasonable, and that's why it's really important to check your blood pressure maybe once or twice a day over a course of time of a week or two. So it really gives us a great idea of the range of where you're at.
Thanks a lot for that call. Is there an optimal time of the day to take your blood pressure to get a reading that's going to be helpful?
Yeah, important question. A lot of our patients are on medications, at least one, and we typically recommend an hour after you you take your medicine in the morning. Most all of the blood pressure medicines are best off administered in the morning.
Dr. David Sabger, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Ann. Always a pleasure.
Dr. David Sabger is a cardiologist at Mount Carmel Health and the founder of the nonprofit Walk with a Doc. More Wellness Wednesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Steven Brenner had been waiting for surgery on what doctors called a destroyed hip for more than a month. He was on bed rest for the entire time. On the day of his surgery, Steven was being helped into a car when he convulsed and went unconscious. 53-year-old Steven Brenner passed away from a blood clot that had formed in his left leg. Blood clots affect at least 900,000 Americans every year, resulting in about 100,000 premature deaths. Here to talk about the dangers of blood clots is System Medical Director of Vascular Medicine at Ohio Health, Dr. Raghu Kaluri. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Ann.
Also joining us is the widow of Steven Brenner, Michelle Brenner of Dublin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
I know this has become a passion for you to get the word out to people.
Well, it has. It was so first of all, obviously, we didn't expect to lose Steve. We thought we were just waiting for a hip replacement. But in the months afterwards, I've come to learn how common it is. And it just seems kind of appalling to me that we don't hear very much about it and that the, you know, like Dr. Kaluri is a vascular medicine specialist, so he knows all about it, but you don't necessarily hear it from your regular doctor.
Or from your hip doctor or your...
Right. That yeah. You need to be aware of this, right?
What do you know about how his blood clot did form?
Well, what we know is that... You only know this kind of stuff from autopsy.
Right.
What we know is that he had a big clot in his, I never say the name of the vein right, popliteal vein in his left leg. So that was not even the leg that was going to be, it was his right hip that was. So it was from sitting.
It wasn't related to the hip problem, but it was related to his
immobility.
His immobility,
right,
was from the hip problem. It,
he did have a family history of pulmonary embolism.
Okay.
His sister Jill had a pulmonary embolism. Luckily, she survived. Hip injuries do have higher prevalence of blood clots, but we did not know that at the time.
Is that just a correlation, though, Dr. Kaluri, at this point? A correlation versus a causation. The hip problem isn't causing the blood clot, but it's related to it.
It's not a correlation. It's a cause itself. The causes of blood clots are something that you acquire, something that you inherit, cancer, and finally, if you don't find anything, we call it unknown. So those are the four different buckets. So something that you acquire, you know, that particular bucket, you have orthopedic surgeries, any hospitalization, congestive heart failure related admission to the hospital, road traffic accidents, you know, any type of trauma to the legs, birth control pills, hormone replacement therapy. So all of those things are known to increase the risk for blood clots. So these are not correlations. They are, you know, known to increase the risk for blood clots.
This might sound like a stupid question, but what is a blood clot? I mean, we talk about our blood clotting when we've been wounded.
Right.
How does blood clot in the vein?
So it's a very good question. So we all maintain the flow of blood in our circulation, and we're walking a fine line. So, for example, when we cut ourselves, we we bleed, we stop bleeding, right? And we scar up, we scab up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the process in that? The blood gets out, right? And your body's clotting mechanism is trying to stop so that we don't, you know,
bleed to death,
yeah. Right? So the bleeding and clotting is that fine balance that we, you know, it's a tightrope we are walking on a daily basis, right? So if the clotting mechanism overtakes the bleeding mechanism, then you'll end up having these blood clots, which is, you know, blood is liquid and clots are like toothpaste. And they start growing. And once they grow, they can move. Okay, so the circulation from the veins goes into the lungs, you know, through the heart to get oxygenated. And when it packs the lung, there's nothing coming back to the heart.
Okay.
And that circulation to the heart gets impaired. And, you know, patients who get a large pulmonary embolism don't get this applied to the brain. And that's how they pass.
By the time that the clot passed for Steve, I mean, I don't believe that there was anything that could have, you know, I immediately started CPR. The squad came. They continued CPR, all the stuff. But what really needed to happen is weeks earlier, he needed to be in compression hose or in pneumatic compression devices or moving around. But he couldn't move around because he was in such ridiculous
pain. So that's
where
the devices
pain.
And the compression hose come into play is
right.
They do what, Dr. Kaluri?
So what they do is it's called a Virchow stride. So basically you need to have the blood flowing in a streamline. You have to have, you know, a good blood vessel wall that is uninterrupted, okay? And all of that happens when our calves are squeezing, and it's called a calf pump, right?
Okay.
We don't have extra hearts in our legs to pump it back up. So when we walk, the calves kind of squeeze the blood.
The muscles and that,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah. The calf muscle pump. You know, pushes the blood back up and maintain, you know, that Virchow stride to keep the blood in the blood form. When one of those disrupts, then you end up having a clot.
And nobody told you about this, Michelle Brenner, beforehand?
No. And the reason I was just smiling a little bit is, are you squeezing your calves right now?
I know.
That's
I'm like,
what I'm doing.
flexing my feet, whatever.
No.
Because I sit a lot in this chair.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, you maybe hear things like on a long flight, get up and walk around, or if you have a long car drive. I mean, so we had heard those kinds of things, but just, you know, in the world of hurt that Steve was in that summer, we did not connect those dots. And no, the doctor didn't say anything about ahead of time. They talk about after hip surgery, and there's a lot of emphasis about preventing blood clots in the hospital, which is really good because hospitalization is a huge risk factor for blood clots. But if you're immobile for weeks, somebody needs to you need to be in compression hose or pneumatic compression devices or anticoagulants.
Someone needs to tell you to do this.
Something needs to happen.
Yeah, you're nodding. This has to be pretty common then, people preparing for a kind of a surgery, immobilized by that. Dr. Kaluri, where's the protocol?
So that's a good question. There is, you know, there's no good data to show, you know, or there are no guidelines, as we discussed, Michelle, when we were talking about this, in regards to, you know, how you care for patients who are immobile waiting for surgery. What has happened over the past several decades is the hospitalization has gone down, where, you know, 40 years ago, if someone had a, you know, small problem, they would be admitted in the hospital, kept in for 25 days, whatever it did, you know, and then
until
be
surgery.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Now the protocols are minimize hospitalizations, you know, and take care of the patient, you know, as much as possible outside of the hospital. And there are lots of goods to that because you're in your home environment, not in the hospital. But not exposed to infections and those type of things. So prior to hospitalization, is not well studied, and there are no guidelines at all in regards to people waiting for surgery. Like Michelle said, there are set guidelines.
After they send you home with your checklist of what to do and when to do it. Interesting. Yeah. Questions or comments about blood clots, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Logan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Logan.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Excellent. I just really wanted to make a quick comment and just kind of reinforce the fact that this is a pervasive issue. I'm a relatively young man. I'll be turning 32 here shortly, but a couple of years ago, I experienced a traumatic ATV accident where I crushed my left foot, and I was, like your guests are describing, immobile for about a couple of months. And as I was in and out of the doctor's office with my orthopedic surgeon, I kept on, bringing this issue up. I was concerned about blood clots forming because of my immobility and the traumatic injury to my leg. And they were very, I would say, hesitant to forward me on for a blood screening. And once they finally did, it turned out that I had developed two DVTs, or deep vein thrombosis, one in my left calf and one behind my knee. So I definitely want to see some progress going forward. I want to see this issue taken care of, or taken seriously. Get on top of this. This is, like I said, a very pervasive issue, and I want to see something done about it. So I'll just make that quick comment, and I'll take my answer off here.
Logan, you're all recovered?
I am all recovered. Like I said, this is back in 2015. It took quite some time. I was on a blood thinner for a three-month period, which I was told is kind of the standard regimen for these type of issues, new issues in patients. So it is all healed up. It's something I have screened about once a year just to kind of follow up and make sure there's no issues. Unfortunately, that's been the case, but it's something that's always, lingering in the back of my mind, a concern, and it can be deadly, as your guests are unfortunately aware of.
Logan, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Does age have anything to do with it, Dr. Kalura?
Of course. As we age, we add risks. It's called the multiple hit theory, so especially for women. As we age, the hormonal milieu changes, and that increases the risk. And then hormone replacement therapy increases the risk too. But age itself is also a risk factor. Yesterday I saw an 86-year-old woman, with DVT. Your caller, Mr. Logan, is, 32. I have several pregnant women that I, manage their blood thinners during pregnancy itself and, immediately after pregnancy. Today I saw two, patients before coming here with blood clots. One patient was 82 also. So it just, it's a wide range. I see teenagers with DVTs.
Is there any outward evidence of DVT?
So symptoms is what you're asking,
well,
right?
Or that you can see.
Yes, there are. But, we were taught, during medical school and training that, PE and DVT, pulmonary embolism and deep vein thrombosis, could be the great masqueraders. So the typical symptoms, that are described in the textbooks are the leg swelling, the ache, the discomfort. On physical exam, the classic sign is called the Homan sign, where you flex the foot towards the nose and then the calf hurts. But it's extremely nonspecific. You could measure the calves for circumference difference, but that could not be present also. There is a Wells criteria where you have objective, characteristics that could be done on the phone to say what your risk of the DVT or pulmonary embolism is based on the clinical characteristics. But again, you might not have any of those or all of those and present with pulmonary embolism. And a third of the deaths from pulmonary embolism are actually diagnosed at death or autopsy.
So Steve actually had those symptoms, the classic symptoms. His left leg started swelling, was red, warm to the touch the night before he passed away. it happened to be a Sunday night. It in the realm of the amount of pain he was in, this was an ache as opposed to,
right.
you know, the massive hip pain he was in. So we waited till Monday morning to call the doctor, reported those symptoms to the nurse practitioner, I think, mm-hmm. in the office. And she asked what you should ask about, is there any shortness of breath? So there were no symptoms of pulmonary embolism yet, but he certainly had the classic symptoms of DVT. And they said, you're coming into the hospital later today. We'll order a Doppler, an ultrasound of your leg when you get to the hospital.
But it was too late. But
and he didn't make it to the hospital.
Jessica in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I was wondering, at times I have been diagnosed or they found in blood tests the anticardiolipin antibody, I think it's called, and the lupus anticoagulant, although I don't have lupus. I'm guessing those increase risk for blood clot or stroke, and I wondered if there's something particular that I should be doing. I take fish oil. I take a baby aspirin every day.
Okay.
Is there, you know, should I be taking preventive measures?
Dr. Kaluri?
So may I ask, Jessica, you're right, you have lupus anticoagulant disorder with elevated anticardiolipin antibodies. Do you have a history of blood clots too, or were you just tested positive for this?
I don't have a history of blood clots that I know of. I do have varicose veins.
Yeah. So in regards to just lupus anticoagulants, you're right. You don't have, it doesn't mean you have lupus, but you certainly would be at an increased risk for blood clots. And the current guidelines do not recommend any treatment unless you have a blood clot, because it's always a risk versus benefit. Blood thinners, can increase the risk for bleeding. And if you don't have a clot, aspirin is more than enough at this point. But whenever you are on long distance travels, you know, long distance plane rides across the Pacific or across the Atlantic or a 6-hour longer car rides, make sure to wear those graduated compression socks, not the TED hose. Stay hydrated. Continue that aspirin that you're on. And any signs or symptoms that we talked about, you need to go to the emergency room to make sure that you don't have a DVT or a PE.
Jessica, thanks for that call. Real quick, Peter in Worthington, we only have a few seconds left, but I wanted to get your question in.
Yes, I have heard that most heart attacks occur in the morning between 10 and noon. My doctor told me, take your aspirin in the evening before sleeping. That way, it has time to react with the platelets and prevent clotting when you rise in the morning. Mm-hmm. Most people don't know when to take the baby aspirin, but it should be taken before bedtime.
Okay. Dr. Kaluri?
That's a separate issue. That's coronary artery disease. But aspirin has a long half-life, and what you said is just fine. Yes.
Thank you, Peter. I want to thank both of you, Dr. Raghu Kaluri, System Medical Director for Vascular Medicine at Ohio Health. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
And Michelle Brenner, thanks to you for sharing your story. It's personal, but it's important, and I appreciate your passion and for taking the time.
Thank you for covering this important topic. I appreciate it.
Yes. Michelle Brenner of Dublin, she's the widow of Steve Brenner. He passed away in August 2016 from a blood clot. He was on his way to the hospital to have hip surgery. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.